Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
We will bring back our jobs. We will bring back our borders. We will bring back our wealth. And we will bring back our dreams.
All right, here we go. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. At WBEZ in Chicago today, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Friday, the 20th of January, Inauguration Day. Of course, good to have you along, everybody. Dystopian is a bit strong, just a little bit strong. President Trump delivered a decidedly dark inaugural address today, most of it economic.
We've made other countries rich, while the wealth, strength, and confidence of our country has dissipated over the horizon.
He talked grimly about manufacturing.
One by one, the factories shuttered and left our shores with not even a thought about the millions and millions of American workers that were left behind.
Same for jobs.
The wealth of our middle class has been ripped from their homes and then redistributed all across the world.
And he said he was going to fix it.
But that is the past. And now we are looking only to the future.
It was a short speech, just shy of 18 minutes all in. We are going to spend the next four or so talking about what happens now. Catherine Rempel's at the Washington Post. Cardiff Garcia is at the blog FT Alphaville. They are both in our studios in New York. Hey, everybody.
Hey, Kai.
Hey, Kai.
So, Cardiff, let me start with you. Were you surprised, taken aback at all, at how economically dark this speech was?
I was less surprised by what he said than by what he didn't say. So most of what he said was merely a continuation of the themes that he was talking about on the campaign trail.
Yeah.
But I did kind of expect him to at least offer some sign of reconciliation with the Democrats, who, let's not forget, did have the candidate that won the popular vote. There wasn't really any of that. I think those who were expecting it ended up just watching the speech in vain.
Catherine, what'd you think when you were watching?
I would agree that it seemed to be a continuation of a lot of the rhetoric he used on the campaign trail. What was a little bit odd about that, though, is that during the campaign, you want to describe America as a hellhole, basically, because you need someone as great as the candidate who is speaking to rescue us from this hellhole. And I would have expected there to be somewhat of a more uplifting message. And Trump did sort of allude to the fact that he was going to fix things. I mean, he said he was going to fix things. Things are going to be made great again. Right. But it wasn't quite as uplifting.
Yeah. All right. I got one more piece of tape from the speech I want to play for you and then get your take on how that's going to work in what is, we all know, to be a global economy. Here it is. Hang on.
We will follow two simple rules. Buy American and hire American.
Catherine, how does that work in a global economy? And also, we should note that Mr. Trump does not do that with his own companies.
Does not, has not, continues to not do that, of course. How does that work in a global economy? I don't know. I mean, look, you can try to incentivize firms to do more of their business here through the tax code or penalties of various kinds. There are limits on how much you can do that without sparking a trade war. And beyond that, if you try to mandate too much in the way of Buy American, et cetera, like for the federal government or otherwise, you could run afoul of some WTO agreement type provisions.
Right.
Yep.
So, Cardiff, we are looking at arguably the biggest change in American economic policy in a generation or more. We always say, though, the business press does, listen, the president doesn't have that much control over the economy and what happens. Is this maybe the exception that proves the rule that what Mr. Trump is going to do might actually upend things?
I would actually argue in the other direction. The ability of a president to influence the economy. Yeah, no, it changes with circumstances. And when we're in a crisis, for instance, and there's a call to do something big and radical like the stimulus that Barack Obama passed 8 years ago, it can get done. It's a little bit harder to convince people to go your way when things are going relatively well. And I think right now Donald Trump has a couple of problems. One is that Republicans don't like to spend money. And the other is that Democrats don't like Donald Trump. And some of his planning does call for doing things that the Republicans themselves don't seem to want to do, and even some people on his cabinet don't want to do. So I think he's going to have to navigate some really tough tides in order to enact anything really, really big.
Catherine, that tide will include the chairwoman of the Fed, Janet Yellen. She gave a speech this week in which she said, basically, economy's humming right along. We're where we want to be on jobs. We're close to where we want to be on inflation, which everybody watching translated into, oh, yeah, the Fed's going to hike rates, which is going to do the current occupant of 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue no economic favors.
Well, in the long term, it would, in fact. I mean, yes, if we have a major stimulus package now, when we're basically at full employment or something close to it, when interest rates, inflation rates are rising, and she talked about that in her speech as well, you risk having the economy overheat. So raising interest rates to sort of counteract expansionary fiscal policy actually does the president a solid if, in fact, it keeps the economy from overheating.
I love that we got the president being done a solid here on Marketplace. Catherine Rempel from The Washington Post, Cardiff Garcia from the blog FD Alphabet. Have a nice weekend, you two.
Thanks, Guy.
All right, we'll see you. Be good. On Wall Street today, an up session on the first day of Donald Trump's economy. We will have the details when we do the numbers.
The most important is to build this economy, is to grow it.
With so many inconsistent things that he has said, there's nothing that he could promise or pledge that I would ever bet a penny on.
I think the pledge would be to have him run it like a business. He's going to hire the appropriate people, and he's going to fire the people if they don't do their job.
I think for so many people, the way Trump deals with business has been a big deal, and people admire that. But I think the running America is not just about business, it's about people.
That's John Kramer from D.C., John Wall, Michael Maddox, and Alexis Petrie from Dallas, Texas. Their policy in Washington doesn't just happen, you know. It is carefully groomed, in many cases, by the dozens of think tanks in that city. From the Center for American Progress and Economic Policy Institute on the liberal side to the Heritage Foundation and American Enterprise Institute on the conservative side. They do research on everything from poverty to economic competitiveness to illegal immigration. So as President Trump takes power, there is a power shift going on in the think tank ranks as well. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman reports now from our bureau at Oregon Public Broadcasting.
Having major Washington think tanks, conservative or liberal, close to the levers of power is not new. Princeton historian Julian Zelizer says President Ronald Reagan really ramped it up.
He turned to conservative think tanks like Heritage for some of the actual proposals, literally drafted by them during his first 100 days.
Zelizer says such a close relationship this time around would be a bit surprising, given Trump and many in his cabinet are genuine outsiders to Washington and the halls of Congress.
And someone like President Trump will be more skeptical of what the quote-unquote experts have to say. That said, when you have inexperience, both the president and cabinet officials scrambling to govern, that creates opportunities for savvy think tanks.
But it won't be a slam dunk for conservative think tanks, says budget analyst Stan Collender at the MSL Group.
There are tremendous differences among the different Republican think tanks, everything from Heritage to AEI to Cato.
He says the groups may disagree on trade, globalization, immigration. James McGann is director of the Think Tanks and Civil Societies program. He expects think tanks to shift their focus in the Trump era.
There is a demand for action in some respects, not ideas, driven by donors.
Though McGann says in-depth research and analysis are still the basis for advocacy. And he says countering fake news and fabricated data will be a new priority of all think tanks, regardless of their political persuasion. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Treasury Secretary nominee Steven Mnuchin had his confirmation hearing yesterday. Lots of ground covered in the questioning of the former Goldman Sachs partner and mortgage banker, including something called the Volcker Rule, a ban included in the Dodd-Frank post-crisis reforms on certain kinds of risky trading by big Wall Street banks. Republicans have called for the Volcker Rule to be repealed for years now, but at his hearing yesterday, Mnuchin said he basically supports it with a couple of tweaks. Marketplace's Mariel Segarra explains how the Volcker Rule might change.
Let's say you thought the price of gold was going to go up, and you wanted to make money by betting on it. You could go to a commercial FDIC-insured bank, and it would make that trade. Under the Volcker Rule, that's fine. What banks can't do is bet using their own money. Peter Conti Brown teaches at the University of Pennsylvania's Wharton School.
If you're J.P. Morgan Chase, you're like, look, I got this pile of $1 trillion that are coming from consumer deposits, people who are putting our money in this bank for safeguarding. And I am confident that gold is about to go up. Well, you can't make those bets anymore.
Proponents of the Volcker Rule say it's needed, in part because the federal government insures banks' deposits and wants to discourage them from rolling the dice with that money. Bruce Tuckman teaches finance at NYU's Stern School of Business.
Well, we want them to do relatively safe stuff, and we want them to do, quote-unquote, typical banking businesses.
Things like using money to make loans and mortgages. Opponents say the rule is costly to implement and confusing, and that confusion is holding banks back from the kind of trading that's allowed. Robert Hockett is a professor at Cornell Law School.
The claim is that they buy and sell fewer bonds because they're afraid they're going to be breaking the law in doing that.
Wharton's Conti Brown says banks especially need the ability to trade during sudden or severe market downturns.
In times of panic, you want the market still to be functioning so that buyers and sellers can come and go.
In his hearing, Steven Mnuchin said he shared that concern and that a change to the rule might be in order. In New York, I'm Mariel Segarra for Marketplace.
The populist view that he used to get people to vote for him, I hope he doesn't drop it.
There's a lot of anger in this country.
People were taken in by things that, because they're hurting in different ways or change is happening too quickly, you know, they're not ready for a country that looks different than they do.
So, like, I just wanted to see it, you know, resolved and, you know, everyone just agree on something for a change.
That was Katie Linus from New Jersey and Charles Irwin from Miami, Florida. They're coming up.
With the current administration, we're anticipating anywhere from 10 to 17% growth each year.
And other high economic hopes for the new president. But first, yeah, let's do the numbers. On the first day of the Trump administration, the Dow Industrials climbed 94 points, almost a half percent, finished at 19,827. The NASDAQ up 15 points, about 0.2%, 55.55. Quadruple nickel, I guess. The S&P 500 up 7 points, 0.3%, 22.71. For the week, though, the Dow off about 58 points, 0.3%. The NASDAQ down 18 points, 0.3% as well. The S&P 500 down 3 points, about 0.1%. Here comes my favorite story, maybe in the numbers ever. The Wall Street Journal reported this week on the shortage of what some say is the best performing golf ball on the planet, a private label ball sold by Costco for $1.25. Wax sells a lot more on eBay. Costco up 0.3%. eBay declined 0.2%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Hey, everybody. Molly here.
It's Kai, but you already knew that.
You did. But we have something that we would like to tell you together.
We are doing a new podcast. It's called Make Me Smart, about the things we want to know more about but don't always have time to dig into on this daily program.
Yeah, and it's about you, too, the things that you want to know more about and the things that you're an expert on. We'd like to have you on the show, too.
And mostly it's me and Molly having fun. Check us out at marketplace.org/makemesmart. There's lots more info there.
And please subscribe on iTunes or wherever you podcast.
Looking for the highest interest rate on your cash? At public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's a higher rate than Robinhood, a higher rate than SoFi, a higher rate than Marcus, a higher rate than Wealthfront, frankly, a higher rate than Capital One, a higher rate than Ally, a higher rate than Barclays, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, a higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo, Discover, and it's a higher rate than American Express, too. So if you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out public.com. We can't say it's the highest interest rate, but it's pretty darn up there. This is paid for by Public Investing, 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Ryssdal. We were live in Erie, Pennsylvania yesterday, kicking off our series that we're calling The Big Promise. One county for 1 year where voters and the economy are relying on the promises President Trump made during the campaign. Today, one more story from a company that is banking on the Trump administration.
This is hot and heavy and
very hot
and dirty work.
Very hot, heavy, yes.
Front-end supervisor Marty Learn is showing me around Sterling Technologies. They make big plastic containers, barrels used to collect rainwater, home composting bins, things like that.
What is that woman doing with the blowtorch?
She is flaming them.
Blowtorch is an understatement. The flame is 2 feet long, at least. This is a no-joke factory. It's loud and gritty, and not really surprisingly, it smells like burning plastic.
We run four shifts, 24-7.
24-7?
Yes.
Wow. How's business?
Very good. We're busy. This is our busy season.
24-7 pouring powdered resins into molds that they basically cook in room-sized furnaces. It's 15 degrees outside the day we're here, but there are guys wearing shorts and T-shirts. In the summertime, it hits 100 degrees or more in here. Larry Allen leads one of the teams working the machines.
As far as the guys that's working for me, I mean, they come in here and they, you know, they break their backs. They bust their balls. And it's like, I wouldn't trade them for nobody else.
Larry's been at Sterling just a couple of years. Worked his way up from the bottom, from the jobs polishing and blowtorching the finished products.
That was a messy job, but we got it done.
Yeah.
So then I became a machine operator. After I became a machine operator, they needed assistant supervisor. Then after that, I wound up moving up, becoming a supervisor.
All in 2 years. That's pretty good.
Yeah. So I'm kind of proud of myself.
Yeah. Are these good jobs to have?
I would say so, extremely. Especially because, I mean, everything is here. You know, it's American made. It's right here.
This is what Trump's been promising. More jobs like Larry's. American manufacturing companies with American workers. At Sterling, you start out making $8 to $14 an hour.
Is that good around here, or is it?
Yes.
It is?
Yes.
Michelle Semecki has worked here for 5 years, doing what Larry Allen used to do, getting the rain barrels ready for market.
So is it? It's enough to buy a car and own a house? And
not really. So it's not a surviving wage, no. For me, no. I have kids at home, things like that. But it's not a surviving wage. If you have a family, no. If you're single, sure. It's a good wage to have. You'd be able to get a car, maintain a house, things like that.
She and her partner make it work, she says, and she likes her job. The hours are good. She likes her coworkers. Michelle is 38. She grew up around here, 15 or so miles down the shoreline from Erie, and she's been working since she got out of high school.
Tell me about what it's like around here, finding a job and getting a job and trying to get by.
It's hard to find a job out here. It's nice to have Sterling out here because it's one of the main employers out here.
How come it's tough to find a job?
There's not very many places out here that hire consistently.
Sterling's got about 160 people working here. Plans are to add another 70 jobs over the next couple of years. Kerry Quigley is the president of the company.
With the current administration, we're anticipating anywhere from 10 to 17% growth each year.
Just to get it bigger picture for a minute, right? I mean, you're a guy running a medium-sized business in a medium-sized city in an important state in this country. When you look at the Trump administration and how it clearly intends to do business, the president negotiating with individual companies, raising tariff and trade protections, that's all good with you, and that's good for your business.
Really excited about that. You know, as it was interesting, the CEO and owner of the company lives in South Dakota. The morning I voted, I then jumped in a car and I drove to South Dakota. I stopped in Northwoods, Iowa, to sleep that night and started watching the results from the election. And stayed up, and there was a group with me, and we were like, we couldn't believe it. And we were like, Christmas has come early, so we're ready for it. We were ready for the change.
He says the last 8 years were tough, the aftermath of the recession, overseas competition, well, Canada, but still. And at one point, they were down to just 12 workers.
So we encountered a month where I sat down with the CEO and the owner and his wife, and we were literally talking about shutting the doors.
Literally.
Literally, you know, and so we talked about it, and we said, well, you know, let's give it another 6 months. The next month was one of our best months in company history, and we've really taken off since then.
Taken off with one big caveat.
If I say Obamacare to you, what do you say?
It's painful. It's painful. You know, as a small business, it's very difficult to look at how that cost affects our bottom line, which is a tight-lined business as it is. It's very thin-margin business. And when we had to look at healthcare, and the cost of what that health care meant to us. We were looking at there was potentially the loss to our bottom line was greater than our budgeted net profit was for the year. So you say Obamacare, and I feel immediate pain. And that's, we've survived it. We've been fortunate, but it's not been good for our business.
Are you expecting immediate relief?
I'm hoping for immediate relief. Expecting might be a strong word. We're hoping for immediate relief. Expecting's kind of tough, but we'd like to see a quick change to that.
With Congress moving quickly on repealing the Affordable Care Act at the urging of the new president, it has to be said, we called Kerry last week to check back about health care and his company. He's already budgeted funding for this year. Next fiscal year, though, he's going to be reworking his commitment for sure. We are going to be in and out of Erie County over the next 12 months to see whether Trump supporters got what they were promised. We're going to be putting it all online. It's marketplace.org.
Jobs. Boy, we really need jobs.
I care about him not bringing back the coal industry and going more towards greener, sustainable energy, because the climate is very important for our children and our future.
I would like to see more jobs stay in the United States.
Boost the middle class. As a recent college graduate, that's where myself and most of my friends are, is that middle class entry-level jobs. So the economy is really important to make sure that everything's strong.
That was Doris Krischke from Washington, D.C., Michael Jones from Minnesota, Connie James and Ben McGee from Nashville, Tennessee. President Trump used the word immigration in his speech this morning just one time, but he said three different times that he does plan to secure the border. Marketplace's Kimberly Adams has been reporting down at the Mexican border for us for the last week or so. We got her on the phone from Nogales, Mexico, just on the other side of the border from Arizona. Hey, Kimberly.
Hey, Guy.
So tell me what's going on over there. I saw some texts you sent out earlier. You were driving around looking for people watching the inauguration. Did you find any?
No, not at all. Actually, we were driving around for like 45 minutes, peeking into coffee shops, into restaurants, into bars. Couldn't find anybody watching the inauguration. We did find some people watching a baseball game, a cattle herders meeting. It was a bunch of other stuff. We ended up headed back to the hotel where some traveling business people were watching it there.
Yeah, so it's interesting because the Mexican economy, depending on what exactly President Trump does, but he has certainly said he will do things that could do some harm to the Mexican economy.
It really could, and according to some, it kind of already has. I mean, after the election, the peso dropped pretty far against the dollar. Before the election, it was at like something like 17, 18 pesos per dollar. Driving around today, it was like closer to 21 or 22. That devaluation is coming at a really hard time and making it very difficult for people. I actually stopped at this flea market a couple of days ago where they kind of specialize in bringing clothes over from the U.S. to sell in Mexico. And they said that devaluation of the peso is what's really hurting them. Raul Ortega said he actually expects 2017 to be the worst year for the Mexican economy in decades.
Trump doesn't matter to me because from the fence to the other side, Americans can do whatever they please. They can have strong policies, policies that are beneficial. It doesn't matter. What matters to us, what hits us, is the amount of corruption in Mexican governments.
Huh. Yeah, the pretty consistent message I've been hearing from people over the last couple of days is that they've got bigger problems to worry about than Trump here.
Well, so lay out some of those problems. I mean, beside the peso, there's a lot going on down there.
Well, in particular, what's really bothering people is this recent spike in gas prices. It's gone up like 20% because of some changes in the way the Mexican government is pricing gas, and they're trying to make it more market-based. But what that's meant is just in time for this devaluation of the peso, the gas prices have gone up. And there have been a lot of protests at gas stations all over the country. I actually spoke to one of the protesters, this guy named Francisco Cervantes, who lives in the suburbs of Nogales and raises lambs there. And he said that this is just the latest thing.
Right now, 20%, yes, on gas, you know. Plus, wow. 20% more in food, 20% more in everything, you know, you name it. Gas is the spark that start the fire. Okay, it's one thing.
There's also big problems with stagnant wages and a lack of economic opportunity.
All right, so if that's what's going on the Mexican side of the border, give me the skinny on what's going on this side of Nogales, Arizona, and where you've been reporting for us all week.
Well, it's interesting. They're really hurting as well because of the drop in the value of the peso, because most of their business in that community, especially in terms of retail, comes from Mexico. I spoke to a local business owner there, a guy named Bruce Bracker. He owns a clothing shop there. His family's owned it for generations, and he also recently got elected to the county board of supervisors. And this is what he told me about the local economy.
We're physically in the United States. We're economically in Mexico. So in my business, you know, we're 95% of my customers come from northern Mexico. The 5% of the customers that come from this side of the border, they're in this area because they're doing business in Mexico.
Huh. Yeah, he was saying a lack of staffing at ports of entry is leading to longer lines, and that on top of the drop in the value of the peso just means people aren't coming over as much to shop, and that's really hurting his business.
Marketplace's Kimberly Adams, today in Nogales, Mexico, around the border area, all week reporting for us. Stories to come in the next week, 10 days or so. Kimberly, thanks a lot.
Thanks, Kai.
Kimberly's border reporting, we should say, is supported by the International Women's Media Foundation Adelante Reporting Initiative.
Control immigration, because I'm a legal immigrant from El Salvador and I did everything legally.
It's the wall issue, I think, would be among the silliest and the least productive.
I just want the rest of the world to kind of like realize that we're kind of a country too. We want to be able to help people, but we want to be able to help people in the right way.
Zoila Moosh there from Houston, Jim Fitzgerald from Dallas, Kaylee Lamfer as well from Washington, D.C. This final note on the way out today, in which the White House IT folks didn't waste any time at all, or more likely, really, the policy folks. The Trump presidency wasn't more than 15 minutes old today when the White House website was revamped. The top issues list on that website now reads energy, America First foreign policy, bring jobs back, and making our military strong again. Gone, which should surprise nobody who was paying attention, is any mention of climate change as a priority and a whole bunch of other Obama-era programs as well. All right, we got to go. The markets were up on the first day of the Trump presidency. Our theme music was composed by B.J. Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Nancy Fargali. Star Nieves is the executive producer. Deborah Clark is the senior vice president and general manager around here. Thanks today to the staff at WBEZ for hooking us up. I'm Kai Rizal. Have a great weekend, everybody. We are back in L.A. on Monday. And this is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.